You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is Brian McClanahan, your host. This is episode 38, and it covers the week of August 15th through August 19th, 2016. So we're doing the program today following up our great conference on nullification in Atlanta. We had great attendance, great speeches. Those speeches will be available online eventually. And so look forward to that. It was a great opportunity to get out and meet people and talk about an issue that I think is going to be one of the defining issues in the 21st century, and that is pushback against centralization all over the world. I mean, we're already seeing this. So it was a very good time. We're probably going to do another conference or two on this particular topic. We're going to try to move it around. So if you have the chance to go to one of these conferences, go. You get to meet a lot of like-minded people. You get to hear some great talks, and you get to have good fellowship. So it's well worth your time to attend one of our conferences. We don't have anything coming up at this point, probably not till 2017, but we are in the process of actively thinking about and preparing for our conference season in 2017. Also remember that all of the things that we do, whether it's the podcast, the website, the conferences, the summer school, all the things we do during the year are only possible by your generous contributions. So please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute and help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Okay, so this particular week is an interesting week, and I'm actually going to kind of work backwards in the week with a theme. And talk about how the theme essentially is this idea of North against South. And more importantly, it's an overarching theme that's now taken place in American history of this progressive view of America. And so that's kind of the theme of this week. Everything fits into that in one way or another. So I'm actually going to start with Tuesday's piece. And this is a piece by Ben Thompson, and the title is Truth in the Pit of Political Correctness. So we've done a conference on political correctness. I've talked a lot about that on this particular podcast. We've done some really good work on that subject. But what this particular piece does is go after the Southern Baptist Convention's decision to repudiate the Confederate battle flag. And this happened in June, and I've had this piece in my possession for a few weeks, and we're just now putting it up. But what Mr. Thompson does here, he's a minister. What he does, of course, is criticize the Southern Baptist Convention's decision to remove, or at least stop supporting, or at least recognizing that the Confederate battle flag was part of Southern history. They're going to repudiate it, in other words. We're no longer going to be associated with this flag. And many people, progressive Baptists hailed this as a great seminal moment because they finally denounced their racist past, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that Mr. Thompson does very nicely is point out what the flag really is and why there is overall pushback against the flag. And I was looking through a stack of Southern Partisan magazines that I was given. It's almost a full run. But they, Southern Partisan magazine, as I'm going to talk about in a minute, began around 1980. And its last issue was not long ago from the original group that was running the magazine. Well, sort of the original group that was running the magazine, the one that was running it for the longest. And one of the things that struck me in that particular series of magazines was that about every 5 years or so, you had an issue on, well, this is it. This is the last stand for the battle flag. It's coming under attack. Whether it was 1982 or 1985 or 1988, 1992, 1990, you move forward, 1996, 95, 2000, whenever it was, about every 5 years or so, sometimes less, you had, this is it, the last stand. We have to talk about what the battle flag is all about because people are going to take it down. This has been going on for 30 years. So some people think this is relatively recent. I think the thing that's different now is that people have accepted the narrative of the battle flag in the South more than they had in 1982, more than they had in 1995. That was 20 years ago. So in that particular time period, a lot of things have changed in terms of education and what people know about the flag. But Mr. Thompson gets one thing very correct in this. He gets others, but this one thing is very correct. And he says, the battle flag is a symbol of defiance. It's not a symbol of heritage. It's a symbol of defiance. And I think that's the one thing that irritates people the most about it. When people run around saying the flag is heritage, not hate, they're actually playing into the other side. The flag is, as one critic of the flag said, it's dissident. It is. It's a symbol of defiance. It's the very definition of dissidence. It's saying, we don't want you. And this flag has been flown all over the world. There's actually an issue of Southern Partisan, I think it's from 1997 in there, that has a nice picture on the front of a group of people in Soviet Russia holding up the battle flag as a symbol of defiance to the Soviet Union. It is a symbol of defiance. So are all Confederate symbols. Defiance to an imperial union. Defiance to policies that are unconstitutional. That's why a lot of people like it. And of course, he gets into the fact that, yeah, I mean, racist groups have used the flag. There's no doubt about it. But racist groups have used all kinds of things. Racist groups use the Christian cross. Racist groups use the U.S. flag. But what really grates on people's nerves is that battle flag means more than that. You know, the U.S. flag is no longer a flag of defiance. It's a flag of the empire. In 1776, it was a flag of defiance. Defiance of the British Empire. But now, it's come to mean the empire. It's replaced the British flag as the flag of empire around the world. And so that battle flag has become the symbol of opposition to that. And if you use that flag, then you're basically telling the other side, we don't want you. So for many people in the South, that flag has become to be known as leave us alone. Leave us alone. Now, Mr. Thompson gets into something else that one of the other pieces gets into, but he talks about, you know, had the South been allowed to peacefully end slavery over time, which would have happened. I mean, I know that some people think it would have ended, you know, in 1865. No, it wouldn't have. I mean, slavery would have continued in the South beyond the war. There's no doubt about it. And so, you know, for that reason alone, we can say, well, thankfully, you know, the war ended slavery, but that was never the war aim at the beginning of the war. And again, we're getting into a whole slew of other issues here. But slavery did end. But the way it ended may have been more disastrous for race relations and the future of the United States than had it ended in a different way. Ending slavery is a good thing. But the way it ended is always something that normally picks up on and says, you know, maybe this caused more problems than we realize. When you look at things like the policies of Reconstruction in the South and the push by the Republican Party to really separate and antagonize the races in the South. And if you look at how, you know, younger black Southerners and older black Southerners looked at race relations in the 1870s, for example, it was different. One thing I was struck by, and I'll talk about this in a few minutes. Well, I'll do it now. One thing I was struck by is I used to use a textbook by Paul Goldfield. And Goldfield is a far leftist. There aren't many history textbooks that aren't written by far leftists. But Goldfield pointed out something very interesting, that, you know, race relations are rather fluid in the South. The cities were segregated more by class than race up until about 1890. And that's because you still had this older generation hanging on. Now, it doesn't mean there wasn't any racial violence. There was. But what was the cause of that oftentimes? And was the North innocent in this quote-unquote racist push in the United States? And of course, as we pointed out on this podcast several times, no, they weren't. The Republican Party actually portrayed the Democrats as the group that wanted amalgamation. They wanted the mixing of the races. They were in favor of miscegenation. I mean, this is the things that these are the same themes that they used to denounce the Democrats. Look at the South. They're living with the other race. We Republicans are for good white people and free white land and free white soil, free white men, Free white labor. That's what we're for. Those people want black people around. And that's not good for white people. So, I mean, when you look at how things were sold in the North and the South, I mean, this is actually an interesting part of history that's often ignored. I think some people are picking up on it now. Of course, Eric Foner, the communist, wrote a book about that. But I don't think it ever gets the attention it deserves and what he's really pointing out. Now, some would split hairs and say, well, yeah, I mean, you had Northerners that were racist, but they were all the Democrats. The Republicans weren't racist. Not true either. You find many Republicans, not even even ones who weren't former Democrats, you find many Republicans who made very racist statements. And and that's the other thing. Well, these Republicans that are racist, they were just former Democrats. Not always. So to understand race relations in the United States, you need to look at, and I've said this in other areas, you need to know your enemy. And the enemy really is centralization in the state in this particular matter. It's not just the South. It's the policies that were used in the South purposely, I think, in many ways to antagonize race relations. So I like the way that Mr. Thompson gets into that. And of course, he gets in the fact that, the way this flag is taught is incorrect. He uses nice quotations from various people, not just Southern leaders, but other people the history of the church and, of course, the Bible itself. So it's a very good piece. It's a longer piece. It's a little over 3,000 words. But one thing he also says that I think is interesting, he says, finally, if we are to take up a flag topic as Baptists, let's talk about one inside our sanctuaries. Why is it permissible to pledge allegiance to a thing and its government? How are we excused to make such a pledge in God's house? Is this idolatry? No matter how deep our patriotic sentiments run, should we hold a flag in the same esteem as the cross? And this happens all the time. You know, people will pledge, in some churches, pledge to the flag in church. The pledge was written by a socialist minister. And this is something most people don't realize, but you go to any civic event around the United States, you're going to have to say the pledge. And sometimes if you go to any church service, you're going to have to say the pledge. So it's amazing to me how people don't know their own history. And the fact that flag has been used in various ways throughout history as a flag that's the enemy of liberty is often not recognized either. So I think this is a very good piece. I mean, we've done other essays on protecting the flag before, defending the flag, or political correctness. You know, what's going wrong here? I think the amazing thing is that in 30 years, you've seen a drastic shift in how people identify with that flag. There's, you know, back in the late 1970s, early 80s, you had Johnny Cash on the Muppets doing a song, Ghost Riders in the Sky, with a battle flag in the background on the Muppets. You had, Bugs Bunny with Yosemite Sam with the flag in it. I mean, people recognize, well, this is a symbol of the South. It is a symbol of defiance, and that's how they showed it. And it's a symbol of the Southern people more than anything else. Not the symbol of hatred or race or, you know, some people have used it that way, but that doesn't mean their position on it is correct. And I think that's, you know, one thing you see over and over again. One of the things that we need to do constantly is positively promote what the Southern tradition meant to America. How important it really was, by playing defense all the time. Even this piece is playing a little bit of defense. We don't need to play defense. We need to play offense. And by playing offense, we talk about the positive elements of Southern culture and Southern society, what is relative today, the flag, not as a symbol of heritage, but as a symbol of defiance, as it has been used all over the world. What it means, what that symbol really meant, was Jeffersonian defiance to central authority. It didn't mean anything else. It was a flag of soldiers who carried it into battle for independence, just as the U.S. flag was the flag of soldiers originally carrying into battle for American independence. So I think that's the way you have to discuss this particular issue. Otherwise, you're playing into the other side's hands. If you say, well, it's heritage, not hate, you're actually recognizing that, well, it could be hate. If some idiot wants to use some symbol for nefarious purposes, it doesn't mean that everyone thinks it's that. And, I mean, the clearest example is the U.S. flag. There are still idiots that use the U.S. flag for nefarious purposes. Does that mean it's what it is? Well, most people would say, no, it doesn't mean that. But by any stretch of the logic against the battle flag itself, it does mean the same thing. So this was a very good piece. And it sets up what's happening. The interpretation of the South has changed in 30 years. And it sets up some of the other pieces in the week, even though it was on Tuesday. It really sets up some other things. So, for example, on Friday, we ran a piece by Mike Tuggle, NASCAR's Slow Ride to Nowhere. And again, it carries the same theme. NASCAR used to be a purely Southern sport. But NASCAR has tried to add more people. Of course, Tuggle says this isn't a bad thing, but what they've done is turn their back on their core base. As Tuggle says, like many other relationships, the one between NASCAR and its fans dimmed because both parties have changed, making the old love affair impossible to carry on. NASCAR has told its Southern fan base, as he says, it wants to see other people. And so Southerners have just said, fine, we don't want to see you anymore. And he says the real cause of NASCAR's woes, the one that condemns the sport to a slow death, is that we, the fans, have changed. We aren't the car people we used to be. So he's saying, you know, people have lost their love affair with American automobiles. Now they're more worried about how many iPod outlets you have rather than the cars. He says vitals, how many horses under the hood, sticker automatic, how fast can it go? People don't care. We've lost our, but I do think there are Americans out there that care about muscle cars and they like racing. But I think more than anything else, you know, it's not the same sport. It's just not the same sport. It's popular, but it's just not the same sport. And that's because people from the outside think they need to involve Northerners, for example, in a purely Southern sport. So we had something that was a Southern sport, automobile racing in many ways. It was a Southern sport, NASCAR. And they've tried to include people that may not be attached to the sport, and by doing so, they had to erode the Southern in the sport. And they're bringing in other people. The South has become excluded. And as Clyde Wilson said on Wednesday, they've been marginalized as others in American society. Not even good others. You know, this group of others that needs to be condemned. So, this again carries on this theme. Why appeal to people that don't like you? Just be who you are. That's the theme of the Abbey. Be who you are. Respect your history. Respect what's true and valuable in your history that you can offer to the world. And just be that. You don't need to invite other people to like you that probably won't ever like you anyways. I think Tuggle's piece does a nice job pointing this out. Now, on Thursday, ran a little piece from the Fleming Foundation. Now, the Fleming Foundation, Tom Fleming is a good friend of the Institute. Now, this piece, the second part of this piece is behind a paywall. So if you want to see this part two, you'd have to become a member of the Fleming Institute, or Fleming Foundation, I'm sorry. Tom Fleming was the former editor of Chronicles Magazine. The first part of this piece actually appeared in the second issue, which is 1980, of the Southern Partisan Magazine. Now, Sam Francis, Clyde Wilson, John Shelton Reed, and Tom Fleming and Chris Kopf created the magazine back in 1980. And then it was, they got some a fusion of cash, and then some of the people took it over. But I don't have this issue. The first issue I have right now that I'm looking through is 1982. But you know, you think about, you know, Clyde Wilson was on the ground starting along with Tom Fleming, Southern Partisan, which was a great magazine for a long time. And this appeared in 1980. And he talks about, you know, 1980. So Tom at the time was probably in his late 30s, maybe, you know, late 30s, maybe 40. So he said he was driving up to Chapel Hill, and he drove through the Carolinas. And he went through these little cities, and he talked about how ugly they had become, not because of decay, but because of progressive influence. And he says, Chapel Hill, they like to call it a village, but not a real village, but as the residents like to imagine, a replica of some dear little European village, complete with Rathskeller and Old War gift shop. Actually, it's more like a suburb of Cambridge, Massachusetts, than a village. Some students used to joke that they only began for the faculty when the New York Times arrived. When I was an undergraduate in the early 1960s, it was usually called Commie Hill. That was before the South joined the Revolution, voted for FDR, and embraced fellow Southerner Jimmy Carter. He says, go there sometime and see what generations of well-intended professors and their wives can do to a Southern town. They live in housing developments with names like Heritage Hills, where the street names commemorate great events of their past, Brandywine, Trenton, Concord. The developers do not seem to have heard of Kings Mountain, Cowpens, or Chancellorsville. The professors shop at gourmet food stores, where you might still be able to find a sack of grit somewhere between the imported wines, matzo, and mung beans. And then he says, most alien residents of Chapel Hill claim to like the South. They ought to try visiting sometime. This is great. The village is kind of Disney World, where second-rate Yankees with PhDs come to get a taste of the South without running the risk of meeting too many Southerners. And this is true. I mean, you have a lot of places in the South that have been completely Yankee-fied. And he says, Chapel Hill, the whole town stinks cute to high heaven. Anything is better than being cute, even the progressive filth and carelessness you cannot help noticing on a drive south from Maryland and Virginia. We usually blame it on climate, but perhaps it is just that the South never recovered from having other people to do their work. And what he's saying here, essentially, is the South and being rebuilt was allowing Northerners to come in and rebuild the South. And this is an interesting point. While we were at the conference, there was a graduate student there. And he's interested in planning, in urban and regional planning. One thing that you'll find in the South that I think is just really striking, you mentioned, I wonder why you see all these great progressive-looking buildings in the South. Now, great, not meaning he liked them, but great in terms of they popped up all over the place in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I drive through my own town, and I see so many buildings that are just ugly. They are Soviet-style architecture. And I think that's because the South was bringing in outside influences because Southerners wanted to seem progressive. We didn't want to seem like we were attached to the gone with the wind days. We didn't want to seem backwards. And so we brought in all these progressive architects to design buildings to make us look more modern. Look at us. We're modern. We embrace you, the North. We embrace you, progressives. We're just like you. And there were a lot of Southern progressives who were trying to be modern. And I think that's what you find when you look at things that are more odious in Southern history. You know, we'll get into this in the last piece that actually ran Monday. But that's the case. You invite things in to make yourself seem better. Well, we're going to support that because it's better. It's the right thing to do. It's better. It's progressive. It's progressive. It's modern. And by doing that, of course, you're destroying the tradition that made the South what it was and why everyone liked it. I mean, people came down to the South or wanted to be in the South because they liked the traditional part of it. The hospitality, the manners, By accepting the progressivism, you're destroying those things. Even progressive architecture, which is just hideous. Now, planning, there's this push now to plan in different ways and have, you know, old southern feeling towns as community developments. And that's not a bad thing. In this particular case, though, in the 70s, they were recreating, you know, northern towns, little northern villages or European villages or whatever it was. Now, in some places, even again in my own home community, there's a little place. It's called Old Town, and they want to make it look like the South. You have a little church in the middle of town, a little main street. These things are going on all over the place. And so you create these little communities, and you're creating community. Not everyone buys into it, but you're creating it. That's the whole point, because everything's gotten so big. So, I mean, people like that feeling. The organic town has now gone away, and now you have these created towns. But the neoclassical style architecture, or, you know, something along those lines, is back in vogue in these places, not the the progressive post-communist architecture that you see in the South. And I mean, my own campus is they brought in some outside workers to build buildings that, again, look like they came out of communist Russia. It's the University of South Carolina, same thing. They have buildings there, the Gambrell Hall, which is where the history department's housed. I mean, it's an awful building. It's terrible. The building next door, they just look awful. They were designed by Soviet architects, I think. There's nothing nice about it. And that was going on in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. This modernist movement was because the South wanted to seem modern. NASCAR going away. The South wants to seem modern. We don't want to be back in this, in this period of time when we had the Darlington race, where you started with a parade with a guy waving a Confederate flag on. It used to be called the Rebel 500. You don't want to do that. That's backwards. We want to be progressive. And of course, as you do that, people leave what you're doing in droves. They don't want it. So Southerners need to stop asking people from the outside to come in. And this is where, Clyde Wilson's piece, Your Future as a Terrorist, he points this out. What happened was that, you know, people who are anti-government people or, Tea Party people, they've been tagged as potential terrorists. And he says this is just nothing new. There's always been people singled out in America as the others that need to be dealt with. He says, in the course of American history, Indians, Southerners, Filipinos, Catholics, Jews, German and Jap fascists, the Red Menace, and now selected terrorists have been at various times appointed as the non-persons, enemies of the true and righteous. This time, dear reader, the enemy is you and me. Which is true. And these are all under slogans, as he points out. You know, free soil, melting pot, a war to end all wars, great society, global democracy, diversity, whatever it is. It's all under this slogan, and these non-persons need to be wiped out. And you really can't tell the truth when this happens, when you have these cliches and these righteous terms being thrown around, then the truth doesn't really matter. It only matters that you conform with the current pogrom going on in America at the time. Today, the pogrom is get rid of any Southern symbols. That's the pogrom. Get rid of all those things because it makes us feel better. Whether it costs us $1 million or not, as in the case of Vanderbilt University, this is ridiculous. Because it makes us feel better. We got rid of our racist past. Not really. It's still there. You just don't have the building named after something. And whether that was racist anyways is up to debate. Again, Confederate means defiance. Now, Patrick Henry was a Confederate. All the founding generation were Confederates. They had the Articles of Confederation. They're all Confederates. That's what they were. And, of course, there are people that realize this, and they're not going to stop with just Southern symbols. That's the low-hanging fruit. That's cherry-picking right there. What they're going to do, and just getting the apple off the bottom of the tree, what they're going to do eventually is say, well, now that we got that gone, now we're going to go to this, 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 and this, because these people are all racist too, And all of these things are racist. Essentially, American history will have to start in about 1975. Because that's when we finally started exercising our racist demons, so to speak. But what do you do then? I mean, then you... the real conservatives in America today, in many ways, are the people that believe in the Great Society and the New Deal. Because all the people running for office, quote-unquote national office, support those things. Their effort is to conserve. And I remember when I was an undergraduate, I mentioned that to a Marxist professor I had. I told her, I said, you know, you're the real conservative, because what the other side is saying, we need to get rid of that stuff. You're wanting to conserve what you built. And that's, I mean, Tom Fleming has pointed that out. Clyde Wilson has pointed that out. You know, eventually, and Clyde does in this, you know, eventually over time, the thing that we oppose is adopted and then conserved. So conservatives just support the status quo. And that status quo is horrible when you look at the financial ruin that it's causing and cultural ruin that it's causing and all the other things in America. I mean, that's the status quo. That's what we're here to conserve. He also points out a very important truth. He says, some Republican politicians are playing an outrage and demanding an investigation. Let's not get too carried away by the uproar for two reasons. First, Republican opposition to any left-wing action is always a feeble and temporary prelude to surrender. That is the law of the universe, like gravity. Secondly, there is nothing at all new about this stuff. It has been commonplace in classrooms, the media, the bureaucracy, and law enforcement training for years and years, certainly since the 1970s. It is new to Homeland Security because Homeland Security is new. The Republicans pretend short-term concern to take advantage of grassroots outrage and of a chance to tag Obama. They do not represent serious opposition to this Americanism, or if you prefer, cultural Marxism, that has widely penetrated American establishment and popular attitudes. It is routine communist procedure to identify class enemies for elimination. This had become standard discourse in many U.S. institutions long before the latest example became public, which is true. You have to take the group that opposes you, denounce them, and then get rid of them. And again, this is why the Confederate flag is defiance, because it's decentralization more than anything else. It's an opposition to the empire. It doesn't comport with this Americanism that says the Union is great, we're this big guy on the block, everything we do is perfect. It doesn't fit with that. It's defiance. It's dissidence. That's why the flag has to be eliminated. Not because of somebody walking around, some idiot walking around with the flag saying he hates people. That has nothing to do with it. It's another way to distract from real issues of the problems of the empire. It's bread and games more than anything else. It's bread and games. So again, this is a nice little piece, short little piece, but it's well worth your time to read it. And then finally, a piece that really irritated a lot of people, and we knew it would and put it up. It's a piece by Ronnie Kennedy. It says, David Duke does not represent conservative Louisiana. Now, this is interesting because people in the media would say, well, David Duke is conservative Louisiana. This guy was a former Klan member, Grand Wizard of the Klan. He's a racist. That is conservative Louisiana. But what a lot of people don't realize, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, you know, conservatives in the South after the war were more interested in amicable race relations than the progressives. It was the progressive agenda to really start pushing for legal segregation. And they were the ones that held on to it the longest. And eventually that just became the accepted standard in the South. But right after the war, you had people like Alexander H. Stephens, saying, look, I mean, we need to take care of the black population of the South. They helped us. We need to take care of them. There was a real push among leaders in the South to have amicable race relations, and those race relations were strained by Reconstruction and the policies of the North. The North, as we've said before and as the Kennedy piece points out, had no love for black Americans. They wanted to bottle them up in the South, not let them escape the South, keep them there, because then that became a Southern problem. But of course, the North had to tell Southerners how to deal with it, even though they had very few blacks in any of their cities or communities. They didn't have to worry about this issue And when they did have larger numbers, they adopted very similar to policies to what the South was doing. The black codes were imitated from the North. This is why Southerners were shocked when they became when Northerners became so critical of the black codes, because they thought, hey, we're just doing what you do. Why are you critical of us? Well, because these black Southerners meant votes, and that was a way for the Republican Party to maintain its power. Hiram Rhodes Revels, who was the first African-American to be elected to the U.S. Senate during Reconstruction from Mississippi. He's actually from North Carolina, but he pointed out later on that the Republican Party is just using us as pawns, and that's all that's happened throughout American political history. There's pandering that goes on to get votes, and the real interests of black Americans may not have ever been represented by either Republicans at that time or the Democrats today. And so what this has done is created divisive issues, and again, it's to stir the pot, as Clyde said. The communists want you to stir the pot, to keep people riled up so you can deflect real issues and move in and take over. I've said before, white Southerners and black Southerners have much more in common in many ways than white Northerners and white Southerners. There's a cultural continuity there that people often ignore. And this is what the piece, Thompson piece, said. Look, if not for these things, maybe white and black Southerners would be unified in their Southern heritage and their love of Christ. Because, you know, so many black Southerners are very conservative in their churches. But we have this issue of race, I think, in so many ways. As Kennedy points out, race hustlers keeping this issue alive, people like Duke and then the social justice warriors. They keep these issues alive to keep people divided, because there's a lot more similarity than differences. There are people in the black community that want the same things that people in the white community want. They want good communities, good education, solid families, particularly those who are interested in the church. And so to say that you know, white and black Southerners are always antagonistic is simply not true. And Kennedy points this out. Now, of course, people didn't like this piece because they think it's revisionist history, or you know, that it's not true. So, but all Ronnie's saying is, look, I mean, there's a lot more similarities between white Southerners and black Southerners than people realize, and. You know, it should be the effort of all of us to create a vibrant culture that all people in the South would want to embrace. And that is the traditional Southern culture. He mentions that, you know, SCV welcomes black members with open arms and says, look, I mean, this is your culture too. This is your past too. The South is yours as well. So, you know, I think to say that sometimes we think that it's only, you know, black Southerners aren't Southern. They are. I remember one time I was up north and, well, not even up north. I was still below the Mason-Dixon, but I went into a store and there was a woman there. This is around Thanksgiving. She said, an ethnic food Thanksgiving is what she said. Ethnic food Thanksgiving. And I said, oh, yeah, what's that? She said, we're having field peas and we're having collards And I said, oh, so you're having a Southern Thanksgiving. And she, no, that's not Southern. Well, of course it is. So it was interesting to me that now is ethnic food. But Southerners eat this stuff all the time. So I think it's important to understand the complexity of American history. To understand the complexity of race relations, how the North, as we've talked about in this podcast before, the North was complicit in the issue of quote-unquote racism. They were complicit in dividing races in the South for political gain. And Southerners welcome this stuff with open arms at times, whether it's through NASCAR or regional planning or urban planning. And Southerners even saying, we need to take down that flag because it represents, we need to have these people accept us. Well, the problem is when you do that, then everything you love, everything you hold dear in the South will be destroyed. Once you start accepting that we need those people to like us, That's really the problem. Then they'll start designing your buildings. They'll start taking your sports. They'll start telling you that your way is wrong on everything. You open the door a crack, they're going to stick their foot in it and come marching right in. So that's why we need to have a positive affirmation of what Southern culture really is and why it's so different from them and why it's better. Why it's better. It may not always be perfect. May not always be beautiful. May be ugly at times. But the South was America for a long time in American history. As I've said over and over on this podcast, the South was America. Still is America. Still is real America. And the enemy knows it, which is why they want to take the things away that mean the South. So keep having a positive message about the South, what the South has brought to America throughout its history, the political leaders, the economic leaders, the social leaders, all the things that are so important in the fabric of American history. The South represented those things well. And if you can do that, if you can maintain a very positive attitude about the South and about its history, you can make the other side play defense, and that's important. You have to get into what's called Southern apologetics. Put the other side on defensive. Make them prove that their way is better. Don't always play defense. Put the other side on defense. Because if you do that, if we can do that, if we can actually make the other side play defense, we'll be winning. And that's just by being positive. Don't respond to their stupid attacks. Just put out there what the South really is and why it's important for the fabric of American history, American culture, American government, American society. Until next time, good day.